I'm Chris, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
I have a sobriety date, which is May 1st of 2011. I have a sponsor, and I'm real grateful to come down here. Thanks, Sam, for asking me. Today was a tough day, not gonna lie. You know, it was for any particular reason other than when I'm not doing something in Alcoholics Anonymous, I feel it, you know. And I just wanted to get that up front, you know, because you'll hear a trend through my story, and it's that I'm not good at a whole lot. I try really hard sometimes doing the stuff that I want to do, and a lot of times it doesn't work out. And it's Mother's Day, so, you know, happy Mother's Day to anybody it applies to. This past week, it was like last week was my mom's birthday, and this week was Mother's Day. My mom's alive and well, but I haven't been keeping up with that amends like I should be, you know, and I feel it, you know, and it's uncomfortable, and I'm grateful for that, you know. I was talking to this guy before the meeting, and unbeknownst to me, he had no idea what an alcoholic was. Luke had sent me his number because he's up in my area, and he had no idea what an alcoholic was. He asked me, he said, "So you don't drink it? Do you drink at all? Anything? Like even a little bit?" And I'm like, "No, man, like nothing, you know." And he's like, "Wow." and I'm talking to him, you know, and he's like, "Well, you know, I don't even know if I'm an alcoholic." I was like, "Well, I don't know if you're an alcoholic either." You know, I was like, I'll tell you, you know, two things, you know, that helped me identify myself as an alcoholic, you know, and if anything else I say is really circumstantial or, you know, kind of pointless compared to these two things, you know, and that's, you know, if I pick up a drink, I can't tell you what's going to happen. You know, I can't tell you if I'm going to have two, which is maybe going to happen a couple of times, or if I'm going to drink a whole 30-pack and get some cocaine and be off for a few weeks, which happens a lot. And the other part of that is that obsession, you know, and that's what I feel like, you know, applies to me the most today, you know, because that phenomenon of craving, like, that only happens if I pick up, you know. I got to put alcohol. I'm standing right here. I'm not worried about the phenomenon of craving. Unless somebody like tosses a water balloon of vodka at my face, you know, I don't see that happening, you know, but that obsession, you know, that obsession is what I worry about today that has me, you know, saying yes to things like calling people or coming to speak for you guys. What keeps me on track with taking care of my amends and the step work, you know, that's what helps keep that obsession. In my experience, it's helped keep that obsession away from me, you know. And I came into AA, I'm still that way, but, you know, I was very stubborn, I was living by a set of rules that I had made up in my head that weren't working for me at all, but I just stuck by them, And I came into AA and I had this, they were like, "You need to get a sponsor." Everybody was at, "You need to get a sponsor. You need to get a sponsor." And I was like, you know, "Look, man, like I got a dad and I don't listen to him either, you know, so like, you know, but I got a sponsor just so people would stop bothering me." And I wasn't really willing and I kept drinking. I didn't understand why, you know, and it took me, you know, about 8 months to get sober. And you take it back like all the way to, you know, when I was little, you know, I kind of grew up, my parents were like kind of in a, you know, kind of partiers, you know. My mom was a bartender, and my dad was just a construction worker, roofer, and they used to take, we were like a unit, you know. It was like Gary and Carol, you know, anybody, like all the family friends, you know, all the people at my mom's bar, they always referred to them as Gary and Carol, you know, and then there was Chris, you know, and we were just always together, you know. I never had a babysitter really much growing up. It was just my mom would just take me to the bar, and I'd just hang out there until I fell asleep in the car, and we were in West Virginia until I was like, you know, five or six years old, like in between, you know, first and second grade, And, you know, we were up there for a long time. And then we came back down after a while to Montgomery County, like Wheaton area. And it was like a culture shock for me. I remember they were like, they took me to this place, Wheaton Regional Park. I don't know if any of you guys know about this, but it used to be an awesome park, and it had like wooden slides, and it was huge. I mean, especially for a little kid. I mean, they had these like 5-story, you know, jungle gyms going up, and I mean, you know, and I was like, man, this is great, you know, and I'm running around, and I had to go to the bathroom, and mind you, I'd been living like basically in the woods for, you know, 4 or 5 years, and so like I just, you know, went up to a tree and start peeing, and I guess this guy, and this is in the middle of a public park, like big place in Montgomery County, Maryland, and this lady, this girl's dad run, I guess the girl like told her dad, and her dad like ran up and grabbed me by my arm and took me to my dad, and was like your son was peeing, my daughter saw his privates, you know, and my dad's just like, sorry, we just moved from West Virginia, he doesn't know any better. and you know, my decision making never really got much better than that, you know. That was like it, you know. I could tell you stories that are just like that, you know, until, you know, after I got sober. And I remember, I mean, you know, I didn't have like a conventional, like, you know, kind of traditional, you know, I was like a survivor of free range parenting. You know, my parents just, you know, I had a key from, you know, 8 years old to the apartment when I got off school. I just came home and unlocked the door and got my BB gun out and, you know, and just did whatever I wanted. And, you know, looking back, like, I had 2 kids, I wouldn't necessarily do the same things that I, but really, if I'm honest with myself, and thanks to the steps, of course, you know, if I look back at my childhood, I was loved and had, you know, what I needed, and, you know, and was a fairly happy child, you know, and until I got a little bit older, around 11 years old, my parents got divorced, which was, like, kind of like a huge blow to me. I took that pretty hard. You know, I also got a lot of sympathy from people. I started finding out, you know, that you know, sympathy was a good way to not take care of any of my responsibilities. You know, if I just tell people how hard my life is, they usually don't ask me for much. But my parents got divorced, and it was a little different. My mom left, and I was home with my dad, you know, so it was like I was, you know, I started to get these strong feelings of the difference, you know, and this is all in hindsight. I couldn't have told you back then what was going on, but I did have this feeling where, like, I was too poor to hang out with the white kids in my neighborhood. I was too white to hang out with the black kids. I was didn't speak enough Spanish to hang out with the Spanish kids. You know, I just didn't really know quite where I fit, you know, had, you know, many friends from different, you know, socioeconomic backgrounds, and you know, for one reason or another, they would stop hanging out with me, and I just attributed it to me being different, you know, and having really no place, you know, and not only that, most people, like the people that were divorced, they live with their moms, and I live with my dad, you know, and so I started getting a chip on my shoulder. I probably was getting in trouble in school. I was always like a big adrenaline junkie, like class clown. I loved the attention. I loved, you know, riding my bike off ramps. I loved all that stuff. But when I lost that, you know, what little supervision I did have with my mom being in the house, and it was just me and my dad, so I had no supervision. I really went off the handle. I started skipping school in, like, you know, 7th, 8th grade. Really started skipping school when I got to high school. You know, I was like, I think we moved down from we left Montgomery County to go to, my grandma had a trailer in Gibsonton, Florida. If you guys don't know where that is, don't worry about it. It's terrible. It's a whole town of trailers. And it's not by the beach or anything. I lived there for 2 years and didn't go to the beach. Not one time. There's like a river. And we went down there, and, you know, I was in East Bay High School, and, there's 280 days, I think, in a school year, something like that. And I had 180 absences. Just every single day we would get to school, and a buddy of mine would have some weed or some liquor or something like that. And we would just take off, you know, and, uh, And I totally went past my first drink. You know, that was a little bit before that. My dad, right before we moved down to Florida, me and my dad were living in this apartment that we rented from this guy. And it was like the son of a longtime family friend of his. A longtime family friend had passed away, left the son in the house. My dad got back in contact with him somehow, and it was this like this white guy named Victor, and he had like dreadlocks down to his butt, and he had a pit bull named Guido, and he had a pickup truck, and he was like discharged from the army for being crazy, and just got a check and didn't work, and I thought this guy was the man. I was like, man, he used to tell me stories about like peyote buttons and nitrous tents and all this stuff. Like, I really couldn't wait to try. You know, I had smoked weed and stuff a little bit before then. I had some sips of alcohol. I mean, of course, like going to the parties like I did with my parents, you know, you would get like a sip of a beer here and there. And I ended up going with him to Home Depot one day because I just followed this guy around anywhere. I mean, I really like idolized the guy, and I was like, now I'm like, Jesus, you know. I was like, this guy had nothing going for him, you know. And it really shouldn't be around anybody, any human at all, really. Like, he was just not a good guy. But he, you know, he took me to Home Depot, and he asked me if I wanted something to drink. And I'm like, yeah, man, let's get something to drink. You know, he's like, well, what do you want? And I said, give me whatever you get, you know. And he's like, you drank before, right? And I was like, yeah, man, I drink all the time, you know. And mind you, I'd only had a couple sips here and there. I had no idea what I liked. Had no idea what there was really, besides like beer, maybe vodka. I probably knew those. But he comes back and he came back with the sky blue premium malt beverage drinks. They're like soda beers or something. And he gave me one of those, and I started drinking it, and it, you know, I did not get what I was expecting. You know, I'd seen people's faces turn when they drink liquor. You know, I knew this was, I was like, this is not what I'm looking for. And I probably drank half of it, and then he had some more stuff in the bag, and I asked him, I said, can I try some of that, you know? And he's like, yeah. And I remember pulling this bottle, this wide, kind of tallish bottle, and it had a paper bag that almost fit it like it was made for it, and it was ice cold, and I pulled it out, and I read it, and it said MD 2020 on it, and kiwi strawberry. And I ended up cracking that open and chugging almost all of it. I mean, it was instant. It was warm and it was cold at the same time. And it just instantly just made me really excited and feel good before the alcohol even really hit me, I think. He ended up like snatching it from me, you know, and got all mad because I drank his Mad Dog. And like, had I known, I would have given him his $3 back, I would give him six and give me another one. But he ended up, we ended up walking into Home Depot, and for the first time, I wasn't thinking about any of that stuff. Any of that, my parents being divorced, my place in life, the jeans I had on, the shoes I had on, you know, the schoolwork I wasn't doing, I wasn't thinking about any of it. I was walking through that Home Depot, I was loving everything about it, you know. I was saying hi to people, you know, they were probably looking back like, oh, who's this drunk, like, 12-year-old in the Home Depot, but for the first time, like, all that noise in my head just quieted down. I didn't realize how bad I needed a drink until after I took that first one and got drunk, you know, and I just loved it, you know. And I ended up going back home, and I got all the way home. The Home Depot started spinning around. I got back to the truck, and I got back home, and I ended up painting the whole back of the bathroom door red with the kiwi strawberry. And my dad came home, and I was passed out, and I didn't get in any trouble or anything. I just vowed, I was like, I'm going to do this as much as I can, you know. And fast forward to us moving down to Gibson in Florida, I just started going to school and made drinking and getting high a full-time job. You know, I just, it's all I wanted to do. I was just like, I'm going to live life like a rock star. You know, I'm not going to play any instrument or sing or anything, but just like the sex and drugs part. So I quickly started to wear out any welcome that was given to me. You know, even at that age, I was like 12, 13, and you know, I started, like, you know, getting arrested and stuff for stealing shoes at Shoe Carnival. Not even good shoes. I had good shoes on, and I just stole some shoes just for the excitement, and ended up getting arrested, and when I used to go up to my aunt's house in Massachusetts every summer, kind of as like summer camp. You know, I would go up there for summer camp and stay with my aunt and stuff. And my aunt was a nurse, and my uncle was a doctor, and they had three kids that were all Cub Scouts and Eagle Scouts and Girl Scouts, and did all their extracurricular activities, and, you know, and were like mathletes and all this stuff that just interests me 0%, and I ended up going up there. My dad and my aunt were kind of talking, and they're like, "Why don't you know we have Chris stay up there for a little while?" And I went absolutely crazy. I couldn't, you know, my aunt expected me to kind of, you know, keep up like with what her kids were doing, and I had zero interest in any of that stuff. I was like, you know, I just wanna party, you know, and I couldn't drink up there. They were really, really, they supervised their kids. And I went crazy, and I pretty much told her, I said, I'm like 16 years old, and I'm like, if you don't send me back down to Florida with my dad, I'm just going to run away. I'll hitchhike down there. And they were like, fine. So they ended up, you know, sending me back down, and I got kicked out of, my dad got back with his ex-wife, and I got kicked out of her house for telling her to F off while I'm talking to my father. And even though it was her house, it probably wasn't the smartest decision. And she left and called my dad and said, if he's not out when I get back, I'm calling the cops. Or no, she said, if he's not out when I get back, both of you are out. And I was like, don't worry, Dad, I'll take a hit for a team. And I just like, I just left and I moved back up to Gibson, and we were in Sarasota at that time. And I moved back up to Gibsonton, and I started renting that trailer for my grandma's, and I just started. I didn't go back to school. I just started working and partying all the time, and it just became the only thing I wanted to do. I couldn't go to work without like at least smoking some weed or something, or you know, and I ended up kind of wearing out my welcome. Me and my friends went on like a you know, 3-week binge of just, you know, of just drinking like Everclear, like bottles of Everclear, just bottles and bottles of Everclear. And he wrecked his car, and then I wrecked my car, and all our friends like blamed me for and it was probably, you know, for good reason, blamed me for him wrecking his car, and nobody wanted anything to do with me. And I was like, I know what to do. I heard this before. I'll just go to the military, you know, just gonna go into the Army. And I told my mom that I was gonna go into the Army. Me and my mom had kind of had a strained relationship that whole time, kind of off and on. I would talk to her basically when I needed something or whatnot. And anytime I didn't need anything from her, that resentment just crept back up, you know, of her leaving my dad for another guy and not talking to me for a year after she left. And I ended up, she talked me out of the Army, even though they probably wouldn't have taken me. And I moved back up here. And then turned around and got kicked out of her boyfriend's house in less than 3 months. And at that point, I'm just couch surfing, you know, around Washington, D.C., Tacoma Park, Maryland area. And I ended up falling in love at this drug dealer's house with some random girl that was there. And we ended up moving in together and having a baby. And I had no job at this point. I pretty much woke up, would go up to the beer store as soon as I think they started selling at like 9 up there. And I would wake up and I would just start drinking, and I would go and kind of sell drugs at that point, but not really very well or for any profit or anything, just for like, you know, I don't know. It was kind of pointless. I did a very bad job at it. And just could never keep the money straight. You know, there's always seemed like there was less drugs than I was supposed to have, and I couldn't figure out why. And I started waking up and having the shakes from drinking. My dad had ended up leaving that woman and moved back up from Florida, And, you know, and he started coming over, and he'd be like, "Why, you know, why are you shaking in the morning?" I'm like, "It's cold." And he's like, "Man, it's like, it's June. It's like 78 degrees outside. It's morning." And, I started realizing I'm having the shakes. And the only way to fix that would either be like a Xanax, which is the same thing as alcohol, or if I could make it all the way up to the beer store and get a, and get some beer in me. But we ended up having that kid and we moved in together and I ended up having, a kid in an environment that I swore I was never going to have a child in. Like I said, I didn't really work much. I was selling drugs for a while, so I had all kinds of people in and out of the house. Because of the fact that I was a terrible drug dealer, I would run around robbing people. I would rob drug dealers, though. I swore I was like Robin Hood or something. I would really tell myself, like, I'm doing a good thing here. Like, nobody's getting hurt. Now, mind you, like, I'm kicking in doors with families inside just because, one person in the house is selling drugs. And at that, when you start doing that stuff, you really don't have any friends left. The people that you haven't robbed are don't want to be close to you at all, and everybody knew where I lived, everybody knew where these kids were, and we ended up having a second child 2 years after the first, and I never for a minute thought drinking was causing me any problems, didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous existed. I had a few people tell me I was drinking too much, mainly my kid's mother at that point. But never for one second thought about quitting, until back in 2009, I ended up running around doing a bunch of robberies, and it was like right around Christmas time, so it was like busy, it was a busy season, and so we ended up pulling over on this road. And I got out of my buddy's Cadillac, and he got out of his side, and I pulled this sawed-off shotgun I was running around with out of my jacket, and as soon as I pulled it out of my jacket, it went off and blew the inside of my thigh off, teared my femoral, blew my femoral artery completely out of my leg. I started bleeding out on the spot. I just threw the shotgun. I took like four steps and then I fell out and I woke up in Washington Hospital Center about 3 days later. And the surgeon had to come down to look at me himself because he didn't believe I was still alive. The guy who kind of stitched me back up temporarily and they had to cut open both sides of my leg, like a fasciotomy, like on my thigh and my calf, and just so my leg wouldn't explode. And it was very bad. I mean, he said, he's pretty sure the only reason I was living because he took some of my blood and figured out all the drugs I was on and all the liquor that was in my system. He said, your heart must have not have been pumping fast enough to get rid of all your blood because you really should not be alive right now. I was just, in my head, I was like, thank God. I'm like, oh, man, thank God. And I'm sitting in that hospital, and I had, against my will, by that time, even if you shoot yourself, they still charge you with the gun. They charged me with possession of a short barrel shotgun, which in Maryland is illegal, and discharging a firearm in an urban area. They were trying to get me on all these robberies and stuff, and finally I told my kid's mother, I said, just tell them you see me with the gun, because they just wanted to get me with that gun, and I had thrown it, and so I was trying to fight it, and I said, just tell them you saw me with the gun, and they can get me on the gun, that's fine, so they locked me up while I'm, I can't walk, but they still handcuffed me to the bed, and they had two D.C. PD cops in the room with me for about a month while I went through all these surgeries, and finally they discharged me and they sent me to some jail in Southeast D.C. And it was hell. And that whole time I had some pictures of my kids. I had a picture of my son and my daughter. I take that back. She was pregnant with my son. But I had a picture of my daughter and her, and I started thinking that maybe this way of life is not working out for me. For the first time, and it was weird. Anybody, any normal person would have said, what's wrong with you? But I never said that to myself. I always blamed everybody else. I blamed my mom. I blamed my dad. I blamed that district attorney. You know, I blamed whoever, you know, whoever I could but myself and what I was doing. And, you know, and at a certain point, and, you know, I think I started to, like, work through it in my mind a little bit, because then I became, like, then I wasn't like, oh, I'm just, like, a guy who likes to party. I was like, okay, maybe, you know, I gathered the term alcoholic, you know, and I was like, I'm an alcoholic, that's fine, but there's nothing that can be done about it, you know. And so after I got out of the hospital, I swore I wasn't going to drink again. I was like, I'm never going to drink again, you know, at least for a while. And I'm going to get out, and I'm going to get a job. I'm going to take care of this legal stuff, because I still had a fugitive warrant out for me. Because they medevaced me to D.C. So Montgomery County still had a fugitive warrant out. And D.C. finally had to let me go, because for some reason Montgomery County never came and got me. So I got out of D.C. jail a free guy. I mean, I was on crutches, and I had the little sweatpants that the hospital gives you, and my leg had gotten so infected, it smelled like rotten beef, you know, because they don't really take care of you in those jails. And I couldn't go to a hospital because I still had the fugitive warrant out, you know. So all this started really stressing me out as I'm walking out of the jail. And I'm like, man, I really deserve a drink, you know. I was like, I almost died. I mean, almost died. So by the time they let me out of that jail, with every reason not to drink, I ended up having, you know, alcohol, you know, and a bunch of other stuff waiting for me as soon as I walked out of that jail. I went two stops on the metro. I got out. I used a payphone. Had a bunch of stuff set up at my apartment, and then got back on the metro. Had my kid's mother pick me up, and I was blacked out for probably about a month. I finally got tired. I had to go to some sketchy, like, veterinarian that I knew after hours and get, like, some antibiotics for my leg. And, you know, just really no way to live. I mean, really, like, really no way to live. But it seemed par for the course at the time, you know. It really seemed like there was not a moment. I mean, I was sitting in that apartment at one point, and I could distinctly remember, like, you know, sitting in that apartment and, you know, with all this stuff in front of me and a couple bottles of liquor, and I'm taking a couple pulls off that liquor, and I'm thinking to myself, this really ain't that bad, you know, this really ain't that bad, you know. And I don't think there was as bad. And to tell you the truth, at times it got worse than that, you know. And I still, you know, if I was drinking, I could tell myself it's really not that bad, you know. And to me, it wasn't that bad, you know, because I had the one thing that made me feel good, you know. And you know, some people say alcohol stopped working for them. I feel bad for them. It was working the last time I drank, and it will probably work for me again if I pick up again. You know, but I ended up getting through all that stuff. I had to turn myself back in, and I started ended up in psych wards at that point. You know, surprise. I was on like a 3 month like PCP and gin binge, and I ended up going to the hospital because I just really didn't feel good. And I was like, you know, and we had the second kid, and by this time my kid's mother didn't really want a whole lot to do with me, but she was still kind of tolerating me a little bit. And we had this second kid, and he was like maybe a few months old or something like that, and I ended up in a psych ward, and they check you in, and you just go in an emergency room, and then they're like, you know, they come in and they ask a question that I didn't really think was very pertinent, but they're like, are you feeling suicidal or homicidal? And I was like, I don't know, man, a little of both, actually. And they're like, I didn't know the question I was answering, because then they come in with a couple guys, and they give you like a warm blanket, and they walk you to the elevator, and they take you up to the third floor Washington Adventist Hospital, and then you find out you're locked in there now, and I'm sitting in there, and I'm just like, man, you know. And some guys come in, and they're like, the AA meet. And I'm like, AA meet. I was like, sounded familiar. Like, maybe I saw it in a movie or something. I had no idea. But they're like, the AA meeting. And I'm like, what's AA? And they're like, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, I'm one of those. You know, because like I said, I was kind of came to terms with the fact that I knew I was alcoholic. I used to joke around with my kid's mother when she would want to drink some of my alcohol. I'd be like, no, there's only room for one alcoholic in this house, and it's me. You know, and it was kind of like a joking thing, but I was like, oh, let me check out this meet, you know. And I think one of the nurses said you should go to it. And so I sit in there, and you know, there's a couple guys. Luke over here is one of them, and I'm sitting in there, and I don't even know if I have my gown on, and I don't know if I have pants on under it, and I'm out of it, you know, I'm not, but I'm sitting there and I'm judging these guys. You know, I'm like, look at this dweeb, you know, like, I was like, what does he know about drinking? I was like, I'll tell you some stories, you know, and I'm just thinking, I'm like, man, these guys, like, you know, and they're offering help and they're telling their story. But I remember them saying something about like I wanted to stop drinking and I couldn't, you know, I remember that clearly. I didn't really remember anything else they said. You know, I think they had a girl with them. It was probably the only reason I was in the meeting to start with. But I'm sitting there, and he said that, and I was like, man, you know, let me go up and talk to him. And I think I got their number or something. I got Luke's number, and I left there and with no plan, and surprise, I started drinking immediately as soon as I got out of there. I remember I was like going to, you know, I was going to get like something. You know, something from some guy or something, and they were giving me a hard time, and he ended up like pulling a gun out on me and like putting it to my throat, and he was just like, give me your money. And I'm like, man, at this point, man, I got $20 in my pocket, you're not getting it, man. I was like, you can shoot me. And he's like, he looks at me like crazy. He's like, are you nuts? You know, and I really, at that point, I didn't care. I was like, man, he's either going to shoot me or he's not, but I'm not giving him my $20. And he ended up like, I think he was looking behind him to see if anybody else was looking, because he was probably going to shoot me. And I just punched him as hard as I could, and I ran. And I got back to a cell phone, and I called Luke. And he's like, what's going on, man? And, you know, and I'm like, I don't know. I was like, you know. Like, I don't know, you know, and he, I was like, I just, you know, he's like, well, what's going on? I was like, man, I don't know. I had this guy, like, pull a gun on me, or he asked me, he said, are you sober? And I'm like, yeah, and because I just figured that's what you tell people, like, yes, I'm sober. And he's like, well, what happened? Why'd you call me? I'm like, well, I told him probably a diluted version of what had just happened. And he's like, that doesn't sound very sober. He's like, are you sure you're sober? And I'm like, actually, I was like, I smoked some PCP the other morning, and I've been drinking all day, and I just did some cocaine, and he's like, so you're not sober? And I was like, no, not at all. He's like, all right, I'll pick you up for a meeting, you know? And he came with another person. That was a smart move, probably. I was a sketchy guy, and he took me to meetings. And like I said, people would, you know, try their best to like talk to me and stuff, but I just was not really feeling it. You know, I wasn't happy about what was going on at home. I felt I had a lot of problems that you guys were not offering solutions for. You know, and that was the main thing. You know, I was confused when I came in here. I didn't know what you guys were offering, but I knew. At a certain point, probably a few months after I first tried to get sober, when Luke brought me a meeting, and I had like 8 months in between, and my dad ended up getting sober, and he was a huge, I mean, me and him were like, you know, not much of a father and son relationship, more just like drinking buddies at that point. He came back up. My dad didn't drink for probably from when I was 2 years old until I was 12. He did a lot of drugs and stuff, but he didn't drink, and he started drinking, and I realized why he stopped drinking, and because, you know, he was a bad alcoholic, and he ended up coming around and getting sober, and one day he was like, you know, I'm going to the meeting. I was like, I'm going to get a drink, you know, and I went back out, and things got really dark between him and me. You know, I couldn't stay at my kid's mother anymore. She didn't want anything to do with me. I got caught panhandling with my kids because it was the only thing I could think to do to get messed up. I would take them, I'd pick them up and tell her I was going to go take them out to the park or something for the day, and I would go down to Metro Center in D.C. and I would panhandle, because when I was in rehab for this little 30-day stint, this guy was sharing about how he used to panhandle with the kid. With a little kid him and this girl had, and he got the kid taken away, and he remembered thinking, like, there goes my hustle, you know, like there goes the only way I'm making money. And so of course I'm like, oh, I need some drugs. This guy said it was a good hustle. Let me take my kids down, my 1 year old and 3 year old down to DC, and we would panhandle. And I got caught doing it, and cops like called their mom, and she wouldn't let me see the kids anymore. I assaulted my dad because I was messed up in the house, and he didn't want me in the house while I was messed up, and he tried to get away from me, and I kicked him down some stairs, and the police came Thanksgiving before I got sober in 2010. And I ended up, just couldn't see past myself long enough to think that there was anything I could do, really, you know. And maybe I'm just stubborn, you know. I don't know. Like, I'm a firm believer in, like, I got sober. I did everything I needed to do to realize AA had a solution for me, you know. Because finally one day I decided I was going to, like, have one last little, I was gonna really try to drink like a gentleman, you know. And I was kind of coming around, and one weekend I was like, I'm not gonna go to AA. I was homeless at this point, had nowhere to live, but I had I got hands on like some like dress pants and like a polo shirt or something, and I was like, and I panhandled and got some money for that day, and I was like, I'm gonna go down to Northwest DC, like the nice part, and I'm gonna go drink like a gentleman. You know, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna talk politics and sports with the guys at the bar. And mind you, like I had no knowledge of politics and was doing way too much drugs to follow sports. Not a good plan. But I was like, I'm gonna go down and do it. And I blacked out in like an hour. Woke up in a parking lot in PG County. After like an hour of drinking, or me remembering drinking. And with an ambulance there, had no idea what happened. My shoes were gone. My wallet was gone. My phone was gone. Everything's gone. And I have a head full of AA at that point, because I had been going to meetings, you know. And so I got back home. My dad let me come in the house, and he gave me his phone, and he said, "You call that sponsor of yours," you know. And so I called this guy, Chris Hoover. And I told him, I said, man, I think I'm done, you know. And I finally, you know, I felt like I was, you know. It wasn't the worst I had ever been, you know. But that moment, I just had like just enough willingness, you know, and had been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, that the two things kind of came together at just the right moment. And of course, like the hand of AA, there was guys willing to pick me up for the meeting the next day. You know, they picked me up early. We went and did coffee at the meeting. I remember his promises. It was a Monday. It's a meeting I go to like tomorrow. And we always used to go and make coffee, and then we would go to Montgomery Mall and we would get food, and the guys would kind of make fun of me and stuff. But they would pick me up early. They'd pick me up at like 3 or 4 o'clock, you know, and I would go hang out, or Hoover. I'd go over to Hoover's house, and I just kept doing that every day. You know, probably about a week later, I had, you know, that was my service position, you know, and I had a couple other service positions, because I didn't have anything going on. There was like nothing. I couldn't see my kids. Nobody wanted to hire me. And I would just couch surf. People would let me stay on their couch. I had to be out during the day. So I would like, every day I would like kind of go around job hunting a little bit. And I would go to the meeting. I'd find a place to stay. I'd stay the night, and I'd wake up and I'd do the same thing. And about a week later, a guy offered me like a landscaping job or something. And I took that landscaping job, and then I would landscape all day. And then I would go to like a Starbucks, and I'd kind of rinse off, and I'd go to the meeting, and then I would find a place to stay. And I did this over and over and over again, and really had no idea if it was going to work, you know. And my sponsor got me quick into the steps. He had me doing a fourth and a fifth step probably a few months in. And I had a bunch of court stuff. I had that assault while my dad ended up violating my probation that I had for the gun charge. And that judge told me, he said, if I ever see you in my courtroom for jaywalking, I'm going to put you under the jail. And I was like, you know, he was like, those guns are made for one thing and one thing only, and that's killing people. You know, he's like, you know, he was not happy that I was getting off with 5 years of probation. but so I was a little worried, was a little worried about going back to court in front of him. But I still came to AA, you know, and my sponsor, and I kept asking people for help with all these problems that I didn't think AA had a solution for, you know, and they would tell me things like, man, you should really like hang out with some new guys, or you should, you know, pick up them chairs over there, you know, all this stuff. And I'm like, no, you don't get it. I have to go to court, you know, for this, and I just listened to them, you know, and I made a ton of friends doing service. You know, and I showed up, and people, you know, started to rely on me a little bit, you know, and it felt good, you know, and when the time came for me to go to court, you know, by this time I was giving my kid's mother a little bit of money, not much, like $50 a week, but I gave her something, and I would go over, and she let me see my kids for a little while, first at just the house, and I just did this every week, and I had my first court date coming up, and I asked her, I said, would you mind writing me a letter? I got to go to court for all this stuff. And she like laughed at me, and she goes, I don't know what makes you think I care whether or not you go to jail. And I was like, okay, sorry I asked. And I kept, the court got deferred, and I kept doing what I was doing, what I was told to do, even though I didn't want to do it, even though I hated that woman. And for no reason at all, really. But I just kept doing what my sponsor asked me to do. I would call them every day. You know, I go to the meeting every day. You know, I do my service position. When they asked me to do a fourth and fifth step, I did it with them. When we were working through the other steps, I did it. Not with a very good attitude or not believing it would even work. You know, that's a beautiful thing about AA, I found out. It's like it works with or without my permission. You know, it doesn't matter how I feel. My sponsor will tell me. He still tells me to this day, I don't care how you feel about it. You know, he's like, that is not relevant. And it really isn't. Not one time has my feelings been relevant to the work I needed to do here. You know, not one time have I ever, wanted or not wanted to pick up a new guy and felt any different afterwards. You know, like it just doesn't matter. You know, and I ended up, I kept doing this, and finally my kid's mother would let me bring the kids to the sober house that I got let into. Some people let, about 3 or 4 months sober, some people let me move into their house, so she would let me bring the kids over to the house, and she ended up asking me, she said, don't you have a court date coming up? And I was like, yeah, I do. She handed me an envelope, and I didn't think anything of it. I just walked back to the car, and I thought it was like, I never get anything good in an envelope, you know. Never get anything good. I thought it was like a new, like she was like suing me for something. I don't know. I had no idea what it was. But I grabbed the envelope and I got in the car and I read it. And it was basically a letter saying that it would be detrimental to my kids' well-being if I was removed from them. That she doesn't know what's going on and she's not a huge fan of me. But something is different in my life, you know. And that was the first tangible thing I'd been given in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because I didn't really see it. I still felt crazy. I still felt like I was just a terrible guy, and I was a terrible guy. But I still felt that way. But somebody else who really didn't like me was able to see past it, pure hate that she had for me, and see that something was working in my life, you know, and care enough for her own kids to let the judge know. In case maybe he might be willing to let me stay out, you know. And I ended up going to court and had a bunch of people show up for me, and all these friends that I had made doing service, and my sponsor was there and was able to tell the judge that I worked through the steps and where I was at and stuff. And I gave the judge this letter, and I think that letter was the only thing that kept me out of jail. And when I got out of jail, I mean, that was like that was like a big thing I had coming up. And then, you know, so then it was like, you know, okay, you know, I was able to stick around, you know, I had, you know, kind of built a little bit of a foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous. So even though that good thing, you know, that happened to me, wasn't able to take me out of AA, because that's the stuff I worry about today. It's not really like the bad stuff. You know, a lot of times bad things, when it happens to me, my first reaction is to kind of lean into AA. You know, but when I start getting a lot of gifts, like a pretty girlfriend or, you know, custody of my kids or new job or, like, toys or any of that stuff, I mean, my first reaction is, all right, I can't go to a meeting on Tuesdays now. Can't go to a meeting on Wednesday, you know, and I got to catch myself. I mean, that's why I have a sponsor, you know, because it's like the good stuff will take people out of AA quicker than the bad stuff. You know, and fast forward, you know, I ended up, my kid's mother was started to decline mentally, and my kids weren't being taken care of very well, and I went over there one day, and my daughter's hair was all matted up. I hadn't seen her. I was picking them up every weekend, but for whatever reason, you know, probably some event or something, I didn't pick them up the weekend before, so it had been 2 weeks since I saw them. And I don't think my daughter had taken a bath since the last time she was over at my house, and my son just looked terrible, and I went into her apartment, and I kind of noticed some things happening, you know, up until that point, but I brought the kids back home, and I went to a meeting. The kids loved going to this Friday night meeting because there was a bunch of other little kids there, and I ended up, like, losing it. I broke down, started crying. I had to leave the meeting. One of my sponsor brothers came home with me and was able to kind of guide me through, like, what am I going to do, you know? Because the idea of, like, fighting for custody of my kids, I was like, I have a terrible criminal record, you know? And it's like, it sounds worse if you explain it, you know? I was like, there's really nothing I can do, you know? My buddy was just like, man, he was like, you gotta do something, right? And I was like, you're right, I do. I gotta do something, you know. And he said, well, go do something, you know. And he gave me some suggestions, and I went to a courthouse and talked to, like, a lawyer they have to help you out with questions that you have. And I talked to her, and I ended up getting emergency custody of my kids, and I kept them for 8 months, and I had this custody evaluator get involved through the state, and she really did her homework, unfortunately. It wasn't enough to stop her from sitting in court and telling the master, which is what they call them in custody cases, is that there's no doubt that it's in the best interest of the children to stay with me, you know. And I don't know how someone in any realm gets from point A, which is where I was before I got sober, to that point, you know, other than the steps and God. You know, I mean, I really, really, I was probably crying every single day for 8 months, really, like, having to, you know, rely on some sort of power other than my sponsor, other than AA, you know. I mean, not the principles of AA, but other than the people in the fellowship of AA, you know, I really started to kind of get, you know, some sort of reliance on a power greater than all of us, you know, and it was a tough time. But I was able to just keep pushing. And I got through the custody and I'm still pushing, you know. I got two kids that are troubled to a certain degree. Great children. I love them to death, you know, and they're the biggest gift in my life. I mean, as hard as it is sometimes, I mean, there's nothing that makes me happier than I'm able to show up and be a father to them, you know, not like an ego-driven thing, but more like a, you know, just so thankful that these kids have somebody to take care of them, you know, and really, like, unattached to the whole thing, you know, just so grateful that these kids have a shot now, you know, that hopefully they can grow up better than I did. You know, and it's all thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing that was asked of me to do here that I was like, oh, I was just getting ready to do that. You know, nothing, nothing. Fear, you know, searching in Fearless Moral Inventory. Oh yeah, man, I was just getting ready to do that. You don't even have to ask. No, none of it. There was none of that I was, you know, that I even really thought was a good idea. You know, I'm gonna write down all this evidence. You know, I was like, no way, I'm telling anybody any of that stuff, you know. But I didn't want to drink enough, you know, that I was willing to do it, you know. And I knew for sure that if I didn't, you know, continue working through the steps past, you know, calling my sponsor and going to meetings, that I was going to drink again, you know. And then I get through the amends process, and that's part of what I'm feeling right now. You know, I went down, drove down to Florida, You know, my mom was moved down there. We were, my dad and my mom like switched spots, and so my mom was down in Florida, and I ended up going down there and making amends to her and stuff, and all she asked of me was to please let her be a part of my life. You know, all she asked. You know, and I've had a hard time doing it. You know, I've had a really hard time doing it. You know, and it's probably gonna be a lot of work to get through that. You know. But, you know, I know, if I, you know, keep doing what I'm doing here, you know, that all that's possible, you know, and that I'll be able to become, you know, unselfish enough, because it's really what it is. It's selfish and self-centered fears that are causing me to not be able to look past whatever harms I think this woman did to me and let her be a part of my life. You know, and I called her on her birthday. You know, I hadn't talked to her in 10 months, and I called her today, and you know, I'm gonna send her some flowers, and you know, and I know is it like, you know, and none of this stuff was like my idea again. You know, none of it was my idea. You know, my idea is just like, just pretend it ain't happening. You know, don't call her; she's far away. You know, but I can't do that. You know, I can't do that because the stuff like this that I'm unwilling to work on, you know, will take me out the door, you know, and I won't even see it happen, you know. So thanks again for asking me to come out. It was really great, you know, to see all y'all, and thanks for letting me share.